Hello, everybody, and welcome to Pod on the Tyne, your go-to Newcastle United podcast, brought to you by The Athletic. My name's Taylor Payne, and I am joined in the studio today by George Colgan. Hello, George.
Hello.
Chris Woff. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, sir. Thanks for not saying that, George.
I don't wish you that. I wish you nothing but misery.
Oh, excellent. And a special guest today, Mr. Stephen Best from the All With Smiling Faces podcast. How are you, Stephen?
I'm wonderful, thanks, Taylor. All the better for being in such wonderful, esteemed company.
Well, it's the big comeback. It's the big reunion.
It's like when they get friends back together.
Cast your mind back, lads, to 2019. It's the 21st of December. It's 5 p.m. Newcastle United have just beaten Crystal Palace 1-0. Miguel Almirón's just scored his first goal for the club. We're sitting in ninth position. Everything seems rosy. What the hell happened from there?
Newcastle United happened. So essentially,
yeah, we can probably wrap up there, really, yeah, can't we?
I mean, only really here on Tyneside could things go so catastrophically wrong, seemingly, within a fortnight. At that point, it's looking rosy. Newcastle, as you see, on 9th, they're going to spend Christmas Day at 9th. And George and I actually wrote a piece basically saying... Oh, sorry, George wrote a piece. I'm trying to claim credit for something I didn't. George wrote a piece basically saying Newcastle United WTF, because this isn't normal for Newcastle in modern times that Newcastle would be in such a nice position. And then all of a sudden, fast forward a fortnight on, and it seems that we're back to normality on Tyneside.
Fast forward a fortnight from 2012 to 2020... And here we are. It's all gone pear-shaped, which is a very familiar shape for us and a very beautiful shape in its own way.
It's our favourite shape, isn't it?
Comfort, isn't it?
It is.
It's nice.
Yeah, it's like a nice old cardigan. He's just put it back on. Embrace the misery again for the new year.
My misery cape, as I used to describe it.
Yeah, so since we last spoke to you, we've played five games. The Crystal Palace game was the first one. And we have lost a 3 on the bounce after that, and then we've drawn rather shabbily in the cup against Rochdale. Stephen, what from a fan's point of view, how's it looking?
It to be honest with you, the run of form they were on prior to Christmas, I thought the games they were winning were games that they could have lost. The games that they lost were games that they could have won. It was very tight. I thought it was similar under Rafa. I thought where you'd watch a game. I'll use this season as an example. Villa away was poor. Those 10 minutes where it was awful, where they got the two goals. And then there was a home game not long after, I forget which one it was now, where Newcastle scored a couple in quick succession. And the games themselves were pretty much identical, apart from those periods.
The little 10 minutes that went all way. Yeah.
So from my kind of perspective, I would say that I don't think it's the calamity or the catastrophe that it's kind of it's been painted to be almost. I think it's just something that's going to happen over the course of a season. There's a division of about 12 teams from 8th, 9th down in the Premier League that are all much of a muchness, really.
Yeah.
And they're all a bad appointment, an injury away from just plummeting. And that's, I think it's one of those kind of peaks and troughs that you get in a season.
But it is. We have had that feeling, haven't we, that Newcastle, things have been running for Newcastle. Things were running for Newcastle in a way that didn't feel sustainable, and we said that every week, but they were sustaining it. And so I think they're perfectly capable of sustaining a run of 3, 4, 5 games of defeats. I mean, I think that's just the kind of side they are. It's incredibly tight margins. You know, I was at Sheffield United where I don't know how they won that game, but they did. You know, they were kind of finding a way to win that didn't feel like it was a sort of long-term solution to the problems within the team. And then we've seen that with a vengeance since then, really, coupled with that, you know, big injury situation too.
I mean, George, you've said a couple of times that Newcastle are a team who have to be at 100% in order to play well. And, you know, like, we're always an injury away or a little issue away from the wheels coming off. And it feels like that's kind of what's happened over the last couple of weeks. We just haven't been at 100%, and we're not playing well enough.
I think they're a team that have to be at the higher end of those percentages, and you know, I think Rafa knew that last season. And if they make a mistake, chances are they'll concede a goal. I just think that's the way the team's set up. But
and
I don't.
Boy, have we made some mistakes in the last few weeks?
Yeah.
Individual errors on the pitch. I mean, God, there's more than I can remember for the rest of the season happened in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, and I mean, it's been so frustrating because a lot of them have been at times when games have been in the balance at Old Trafford. Yeah. Newcastle actually started that game pretty well, and when they stayed deep, when they had that defensive structure which has served them so well, Man United didn't look like doing anything, but the game opened up. There was silly mistake, Cher passing the ball away, Dubravka made a mistake, and suddenly you let Man United into it. Leicester as well, although Leicester had dominated the game, they hadn't really looked like scoring until Lejeune makes first mistake, then he makes a second mistake a few minutes later, and they have been costly. And it's a side whereby, as George said, if they do make a mistake, they will be punished, particularly when they're against the likes of Leicester and Man United, who have that sort of forward power.
That Man United game, I agree. I thought the first 20 minutes Newcastle were excellent. I thought Joe Linton started really well as well. Obviously, more of whom later, I suspect. But Man United seemed to discover that Newcastle couldn't cope with the high press. And as soon as that happened, the passes started going awry. And I was at the game, not with, but kind of in the company of a Man United season ticket holder who's a friend of mine. And he couldn't believe all four of their goals were accountable in some way to Newcastle mistakes. Dubravka, I thought, had a bit of a soft hand for the first one, and there was passes going awry. That was it. Longstaff played Rashford through.
Sean Longstaff. Longstaff played the back pass.
A killer through ball.
Yeah, beautifully weighted, I believe, is the term.
But Newcastle have been, I think, architects of their own downfall for a lot of the games over Christmas. Everton's second goal the other day, I'm not too sure where Fabian Schär was. For all, Carroll loses the ball in halfway and it comes down the right-hand side. I forget who scored. Was it Holgate who scored?
Calvert-Lewin, wasn't it?
Dominic Calvert-Lewin, yeah. He's got the freedom of the Leeds' penalty area to put it away. And you can see Schär's his man and he's just kind of peeled away without a second thought.
And then someone like Lejeune, who's come back into the team, I would argue is Newcastle's best defender, you know, theoretically, but has been out for a long time with injuries, come back in the team and needs really to have been taken out of the team, and they couldn't afford to do it at that point because the great bit of strength of the team, which is having six centre-halves who are all pretty decent, they've all been crocked. He then stayed in the team far too long.
I was just going to say, in terms of the high press as well, because against Everton, the second goal came from a high press, and it was the crowd, once we'd had the 10,000 pre-season ticket holders in there, had sort of got behind that. And Newcastle had won the ball back, and a lot of people saying that was brilliant. And then Carroll lost it, and suddenly Newcastle out of position. And it was interesting because when we saw Rafa Benitez for the podcast a few weeks ago, he was saying about, and he was just chatting in general about teams who do the high press. And I think it's underestimated how much work actually goes into that. And in terms of, you have to be alert for if you lose the ball. And Newcastle don't press high very often, and they did in that scenario. And as soon as they lost the ball, albeit a bad mistake from Carroll, nobody knew how to react. They were all out of position, and suddenly they looked so vulnerable.
Yeah, it's been a funny couple of weeks. I think what I've noticed about us going forward is that we'll go forward and we'll fly forward with two or three players, and then there'll be some of the midfielders coming through. As soon as we lose that ball, they kind of all just panic a little bit, and the defence are getting pulled around and stuff like that. And it wasn't happening before, and I'm slightly concerned about that kind of shape being lost when, like you say, if there's a bit of a high press or if we go forward as a, I often think we're at our most sort of what's the word I'm looking for?
Vulnerable.
Susceptible. Vulnerable, yeah. When we're counter-attacking. Because there's always that chance of the team coming back at us.
Well, I thought against Everton, actually, that, and I spoke to a few people afterwards, including John Anderson, who was on BBC commentary, and he was saying that he thought that Newcastle had looked the most effective going forward in a while. And I thought they looked the most dangerous, but I also thought that it was the most chaotic they've looked just about all season. Second half, they did go chasing the game at certain points, and Fernandez was going upfield, Cher was going upfield, Yedlin was covering in at centre-back. And I think that it's a team whereby they have specific defined roles, quite a lot of which are in a defensive shape. And when they go without that, as soon as you remove that structure, I think that they do look vulnerable. I think that you can see that they don't necessarily have maybe the quality and also the freedom of mind to be able to really cope in that sort of situation.
And it's still a team. It's still a team lacking all balance. And it's still a team where, you know, every time you solve one question, another question emerges.
This Athletic podcast is brought to you in association with Stitch Fix, an online personal styling service that takes the hard work out of dressing well. To get started, go to stitchfix.co.uk/athletic. Fill in a style quiz and tell us about your personal style, budget, size, shape, and your clothing needs and wants. A personal stylist will then send you 5 items of clothing, each hand-picked especially for you from our selection of 100 brands, including established names, cool emerging designers, and exclusive brands you won't find anywhere else. Try on everything at home and style with other items in your wardrobe. You can then pay for what you love and send back the rest. For your stylist time, you pay a charge of just £10, which is deducted from the cost of anything you decide to buy. You try before you buy at home. Delivery and returns are free both ways, and you don't need a subscription to sign up. Stitch Fix allows you to save time because we do the shopping for you. Discover new styles. Your stylist could find great items that you may have never picked out when shopping for yourself. Enjoy top styling tips. Our experts will give you ideas on how to wear the items they pick out for you. Get started with Stitch Fix today and support our podcast by going to stitchfix.co.uk/athletic right now. That's stitchfix.co.uk/athletic. There's been a few players who've kind of dropped in form a little bit. Somebody who I wanted to make a little note of was Sean Longstaff. I'm slightly concerned about him and what's been happening with him in the last couple of weeks. He played alongside his brother, obviously, Matty, against Man United. They kind of got overrun a little bit in the second half of that game. The Rochdale game, I thought he was quite ineffective. He didn't really do an awful lot with the ball, and he looked a little bit languid and a bit sort of unfit, I think, is maybe his kind to him. What do we think about Sean Longstaff at the minute?
I am a little bit worried about his form. I thought at Man United that, to be fair, I didn't think the system was correct. They'd played 5-3-2, 3-5-2, whatever you want to call it, against Southampton and sort of got away with it to a certain degree. And then Bruce persisted with it away at Old Trafford. And I thought that it was for Matty and Sean to play in that formation with Almiron, who's not really a central midfielder, that did get completely overrun. And Sean was probably, and both Sean and Matty were probably too keen to get forward too quickly during the first half and got caught out of position. Then at Rochdale the other day, I was, even during the first half when Newcastle played quite well, I thought that Longstaff, as in Sean, was quite wasteful in possession. Yeah. I thought that he looked like he needed extra time on the ball. And I don't know whether it is just this knee injury that still, he still hasn't quite got back up to 100%. I'm not sure, because we saw last season there's definitely a very talented player within there. But at the moment, this season hasn't got going for him.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's the last couple of weeks. I think it's the entire season. And he's not first choice at the moment, is he? Mm. I mean, if everybody's fit, it'll be Hayden and the genius that is John Joe Shelby alongside him. He just hasn't done it. It just hasn't. But we have to remember he's still a very inexperienced player. There was a huge amount of hype about him last season, and rightly so, because he was great. But, you know, by the end of last season, he's played whatever it was, 8 or 9 games, and that's it. So there has to be a bit of patience for him. But yeah, you want to see him develop, and it hasn't happened yet.
Do we think he maybe has had his head turned a little bit by the Man United transfer chat?
I would hope not. I mean, I would hope not. And I don't think, I mean, you know, knowing a bit about him and his family and stuff like that, I don't think that's something that I would be concerned about. Mm. But then again, you know, if you're a young lad and you're reading all this stuff, it's you know, you're going to be thinking about that, surely, whether he feels committed to Newcastle or not. It's something that must be playing on the back of your mind. But I don't think he's the kind of lad who would let it go to his head.
No. I don't think so either, but I think that the sort of contract situation that you have with both him and his brother, that's also true, isn't helping. And
it needs
to
be resolved, doesn't it?
They both need to be resolved, and I think that they're both interconnected. They're both with the same agent for a start, but also the fact that sort of, if one gets a new contract, then the other really does. And Sean signed his contract just before he broke into the first team. So I think the argument that him and his agent make is, look, that was before I was a first team player. I deserve a higher contract. Newcastle have offered him a certain figure. He believes he's worth more, particularly if Man United are coming from the summer and Newcastle saying, we're not interested in selling unless you're going to give us an astronomical fee. Then he's thinking, well, I could be at Man United on X, Y, or Z. And so I think that can't help but be a factor. I'm not saying he has had his head turned, but I just don't. I think that uncertainty doesn't help anyone, because Man United haven't really gone away. They are still there in the background.
Yeah.
My thing with both Longstaffs actually is I think that it's the fans are so desperate to have young Geordie lads in the team, and they really want to see young lads come through and progress. We haven't seen it since probably Paul Dummett, then before him. You're looking at Amiobi, maybe.
Andy Carroll,
yeah. I was a little bit kind of, loath though I am to admit it, conservative towards the end of last season, just because this was a young lad breaking into the team. We don't really know what he is yet. Had that bad injury, and he's, like George said earlier, he's kind of hasn't really settled yet. I mean, talk that he was rushed back at the start of the season. And I'm a little bit kind of, he's coming for, I think the praise was a little bit over the top towards the end of last season. I think it's a case of being patient and seeing where he fits in the team. In my ideal first 11 with the players that are there now, we probably wouldn't be in it. I'd have Shelby and Hayden as well. But I think there's a role from there, definitely, and I would be very surprised if Man United were looking at him. I mean, you lads have got more kind of more insight than I do as to stuff like that, but I, from what I've seen of him in the kind of figures he here touted, I don't see him as being a Man United player just yet.
I mean, I don't see him as being the sort of value that Newcastle reportedly caught, but my understanding was basically...
£50 million was the figure that got bandied around on Twitter this week. Whether that's close to the mark or not, I don't know.
I mean, the Longstaff, the transfer saga in the summer was a bit of a bizarre one because there kept on being reports out of Manchester that Man United were going to make a bid, and they seemed very confident they were going to get it for 20 to 25 million, and Newcastle just did not receive this bid and were adamant all along, we're not going to sell them. Then eventually Man United made an inquiry and they were shocked by how much Newcastle... Well, basically Newcastle said, we don't want to sell them, but you're going to have to be thinking 30, 40, 50 million to even get us tempted. And Man United was surprised by it. It was all a bit bizarre, and it all smacked of sort of a bit of arrogance from the Man United side of we'll just get, because they were working one transfer at a time, apparently. It was all a bit strange, but I think that they underestimated how much Newcastle wanted for someone who they see. And we criticise Newcastle a lot, but I actually think that was a positive that this young Geordie lad, they do see as being someone they want to tie down for the long term. And even if the contract situation's ongoing, the fact they didn't let him go last summer, I saw as a positive.
I want to move on to our number nine, Joe Linton. I want to talk a little bit about him. The last couple of weeks have seen the fan base split. People arguing that he's the worst thing that they've ever seen in a black and white shirt. Some people saying that he's being treated unfairly, he's playing out of position. Well, I'd like to get your thoughts on this at the minute. It's something we've talked about in the past. I know we've spoken about this in a bit of detail in the past, but in the last couple of weeks, I think the atmosphere towards the lad has changed a bit, and it's ended up with actual sort of vocal, what's the word? I can't think of the word. It's ended up with a kind of vocal animosity towards him on Saturday at Rochdale.
Animosity is the word you're looking for.
Yeah.
Which you found. So well
I found it eventually, George. It was there. It was always there.
It was pretty painful watching you go
struggle.
Through. It was like watching Gillinton play up front for Newcastle a little bit. So if everything was in the wrong area.
Whatever.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's the same thing that we've said sort of from day one, really, that... you know, he has certain attributes. He's powerful, or he looks like he should be powerful. He's has a turn of speed about him, but he doesn't use those things to get into the right position that a goal scorer has to do. And it is painful watching him. You know, Newcastle watched him 24 times apparently before they signed him. And the thing that I can't get my head around, the thing that I still don't understand, is where they thought he was going to play, in what system he was going to play, who was going to play with him, and all those sorts of things. And again, I hate this sort of harking back, but there was a balance to this side last season. We saw it when Almiron came in at the very end of the transfer window. Suddenly that little trio of players, Almiron, Perez, Rondon, works really well, and you see it sparking other bits of the team into life. And, you know, I'm not saying that Newcastle were world beaters in the second half of last season, but they were effective and they were good, and the front three were part of it. Now, they've had this deal in place for Gillinton for a long time. I'm sure they thought that Perez was going to stay, so that's maybe one bit of mitigation, but you just can't see it in terms of the sort of patterns on the field. And you know, it can't just be about plucking a player from Germany thinking, okay, he's done all right, he's tired, he's young, he's, you know, he's got talent, and, you know, and putting him into Newcastle's team and just letting him sink or swim. There has to be some sort of strategy, and I just don't know what it is with him.
Saturday was difficult because... Going into the game on Saturday morning, I said that this is... Because we knew that Joe Linton was going to play, and I said this is either the game that could rekindle a season, or this is the one which basically, I think, to a degree, and I hope I'm wrong, but I think condemns it in terms of that this season, in terms of confidence wise. And first half, he had a couple of opportunities, and I thought that the way he set up that chance for the left footed one he put just past the post, he did everything really well until, and then he sort of just he didn't catch it properly and it doesn't go in. If that goes in, if he scores a couple, if Newcastle win 3-0, then suddenly this whole weekend, at the start of 2020 for both Joe Linton and Newcastle United, has got a completely different perspective. But the second half sort of mirrored Newcastle. Joe Linton was sort of symptomatic of what happened to Newcastle during that second half. It just, everything started to fall apart. He has this sort of body language whereby it looks like he's languid. There isn't. It looks like there's a lack of effort. Now, I actually don't think there is. I know he received a lot of criticism over the weekend. And a lot of fans who were there felt that he gave up. I don't think that he necessarily did. I just think that it's sort of just the way that he is and the way that he looks. And he does have this sort of negative body language where he throws his hands up in the air. He looks frustrated. But I just think that there's a combination of factors. And I feel for him to a degree. But and in an ideal world, you take him out of the team. But Newcastle lack options; they don't.
Just can't do it. Yeah.
Carroll had a bit of an injury; couldn't have played against Leicester as well. So Joe Linton's playing as this central striker, where when he has looked at his best, he's been either wider or slightly deeper. And so that's where I think that Bruce needs to try and fit him into the team somewhere, because I just don't think it works as a central striker from at the moment.
I agree. I agree with Chris. That chance he had against Ross Jewell at the weekend, it put us in mind a lot of the goal he scored against Spurs. Where he's kind of opened his body up, the goalkeeper's flat-footed, and it's just a case of sitting here with millions of goals under my belt over the years. It's not just Christmas, it's goals in there. You think, well, it's rolling the bottom corner, and that's it. You could be off and running. If that header doesn't get deflected off the post in the second half, are things different? I really want to like him. And I've kind of backed him in the face of criticism quite a bit this season. But after that second half against Rochdale, it was difficult because there was an awful lot happening. There was one where he tried to head a ball out towards the right-hand side and it went out for a throw-in quite meekly and was no one around. And what's he seen? Why has he done that? Has he seen a pass on? Should there be somebody there? Or is he just kind of just getting rid of it for the sake of getting rid of it? Is it a confidence thing? Is it a composure thing? I don't know. If he's been watched 24 times, they must have seen the position in which he was playing, and that's how we are going to use him. And maybe the Perez thing might be mitigation. But there's no way he could have been playing for Hoffenheim, was it he was at?
Yeah.
The way he started at Newcastle, or the way he's been used at Newcastle. Hmm. And I was talking about this last night. I don't know, is it time to give him a rest? You've got to juggle his confidence against his form, and if you give him a rest, what's that going to do to him personally? He's a young lad who won't have ever played anywhere like Newcastle before as regards to the city, the way the stadium is, the weather. I don't know how much English he speaks, because I don't think we've got many Portuguese speakers in the squad. Correct me if I'm wrong. It could be quite lonely, you know, and I think Nibusi gets won't help him.
I think there is a difference, though, from a fan's point of view. There is a difference between abuse.
Yeah.
And I don't think abuse is ever warranted, really. But I think there is a time when you need to criticise a player for playing badly and when his performance levels don't come up to the level required. And I think there's been times when Joe Linton hasn't played well enough. And I think he should be playing better. He should be doing more. He should be making himself more available. He should be holding the ball up. He should be, you know. There's times when criticism and abuse, they're two different things.
I agree.
I've been critical of him. I haven't abused him, but I've been critical of him. And then you get somebody else coming back and saying, well, you can't say this, you can't say that. You know. And then they always say, he's not a striker, he's a young lad, he's, you know, all that sort of stuff. But you can't take away the fact that he's not played well.
I mean, again, something that we've said quite often is that Newcastle get a lot of support or positive support because we know that they're an honest team and that they're trying hard, and that, you know, I think we've felt like that for 2 or 3 years, that it's, you know, it's a no dickhead kind of team and stuff like that. And I think that's important. And, you know, it can be a pleasure to watch them even if they're not doing very well, because you know they're giving everything. I want my Newcastle players to do that. Mm-hmm. I think with Jolinton, he's almost a symbol of something, isn't he? I mean, it's 40 million quid. I mean, it's not his fault, but that is a phenomenal amount of money for Newcastle, you know, and particularly for this Newcastle. And so he comes to symbolise something. And if he comes to symbolise failure, then that's tricky to get out of that. And, you know, it's a club where the manager takes the brunt of everything because he's the spokesman for everything, effectively. Mm. So everything Steve Bruce says is looked at and picked apart and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And the first sign of contradiction, or the first sign of embellishment, or the first sign of, you know, doing stuff is picked apart. I understand that. On the pitch, Jolinton is almost the same kind of symbol. He symbolises this regime in some way. And because it's going badly wrong for him personally at the minute, it almost becomes something else. And I realise that's a sort of, that's a esoteric way of looking at Jolinton, but I think there is something to that, that he symbolises, at the moment, he symbolises the club's failure.
Like the frustration of the post-Rafa lights? That's not a thing, is it? But yeah, I can see that. I think Steve Bruce has had that as well. Now, I've in the past criticised him quite, not quite fairly, I thought, but perspective. Where I think it's that much it was ambition under Benitez, and I don't want to kind of hark back to this too much because it's been done to death. And it feels that with his contract ending in June, July, and Steve Bruce coming in, it was so underwhelming, and it felt like a massive regression to the McLaren days almost. And I don't want to say results this season mirror that, but when McLaren was manager, the double was done over Tottenham. I think they got a good result at Anfield, I seem to recall. They put six past Norwich, and there are, I'm not saying it's going to end that way. They could finish anywhere from 8th to 20th. There's really no way of kind of forecasting, as far as I'm concerned, how it's going to end. But yeah, it feels as though it might well become like a figurehead of that frustration.
Because it's that thing where, you know, it was put to Benitez in February. We've got this deal. We've got this incredible deal for Jolinton, £40 million. And Benitez shrugs his shoulders and says, well, at the moment, I'm not contracted to be on the summer, so I'm not going to sign that off. But equally, I don't think he's worth £40 million. Mm. Okay, well, Mike Ashley will put £20 million quid of his own money in and take it. So it's not part of your budget. And it's like, well, I don't really think he's worth £20 million quid, you know. And if I've got £20 million quid, I'd want to spend it on something else. And so there's this symbol of something that the regime, you know, they've staked a lot on this, not just in terms of money. There isn't a lot of credibility there, but you know, they've staked it on this player that as if they know something, and it's not worked, and so it's another stick to beat them with.
I don't think there is mitigation for Newcastle in this one either, and I'll say that for several reasons, and I feel for Jolinton in this, because if they didn't see Perez coming, well, Perez said several times last season that he was potentially thinking about going. That was something that they should have been planning for. And also, I think if Jolinton had been a replacement for Perez, there maybe would have been more logic to the situation, because he's never been a prolific goal scorer. He may have brought something different. I also think, as you say, Benitez had said that he didn't think he was worth that sort of money. And even if Ashley did pledged to give £20 million, did he then give £20 million when he was signed under Bruce? Because if Bruce is, I've said this before, I think if Bruce was the man that he wanted, and he's waxed lyrical about, why didn't he put another £20 million in last summer for that? If this, and then if Jolinton's this central striker, this number nine, that he's now 22 games in, he's scored one goal, and he doesn't look like he's in that position. I don't think there is much mitigation for this. I feel that he's been parachuted into this situation, Jolinton, where so much has been expected of him because of all of the background, and that's not his fault, and he isn't playing well, and he wanted the number nine shirt and he wanted the move, but I do feel for him to a certain degree that he's been put in this position. And I just, at the moment, you wonder where Newcastle think they're going to get a return on this £40 million, because this season you can't see it, so it's going to have to be a real long-term project to really make sure that this guy does turn into the player they want.
Is it possible to undertake a long-term project like that with the way the club is, though? Because there's so much uncertainty around things. And I mean, you know, Steve Bruce is not what we would class as being a coach who has a long record of developing young players. So is that something which is something we can expect?
Or? They sort of have to make this work, don't they?
So
you would, again, you would hope that part of the strategy for this month, I mean I almost feel like laughing at myself for using the word strategy, but part of the strategy of this month shouldn't just be, okay, we need goals. It needs to be, okay, we need goals, but we need to make this team work. So in other words, just getting a striker who scores goals, that would be lovely, but you know, you also need to get a striker who fits into the system they're playing, who fits in with the players who are already there, who brings some balance, and who brings other players in and stuff like that. And so there's that sort of natural improvement. And so you would think they'd be, or you'd hope that they'd be thinking, how do we bring somebody in that allows Jolinton to show himself off as a £40 million footballer? If that's, I mean, that is what he is, because they've paid £40 million all in one go, apparently. I mean, all is not lost, because, again, people will be sick of hearing this. He's young. It can take time to adapt. It, You know, it just can. We've seen that countless times in football. It can take a year. The frustration with that is that Newcastle didn't have a year.
Don't have a year, yeah.
You know, they didn't have that. Problem. Once you've paid that sort of money, once you decide you're not going to keep the players that are already here, then, you know, you're taking a gamble. And by all those metrics, we can see Newcastle are on the bottom of list for scoring goals. And it's a big concern because they've been riding their luck.
Mm, yeah. Is there a chance he could get sent out on loan in January? Is that a possibility?
I don't think so, but it was funny because I spoke to a guy who was heavily involved with them at Hoffenheim. He was their head of basically their head of recruitment. He's not there anymore, but for a piece that I did a while ago on The Athletic, and he sort of, this was back in late October, early November, and at the time he said that he made a joke and said he's at Freiburg now, and he said if they want to send Joe Littenau for the second half of the season, we will have him. We know where best to play him, yeah. how best to use him, and that he needs time, and that is part of the problem. Is it seems like it's sort of square pegs, round holes. He's playing in this where he wants to play. He said he wants to play as a centre forward. You asked if he'd spoke English. The only interview he's done in English was with me very briefly after the West Ham game, whereby he was literally shaking because he doesn't speak that much English. Law, he was quite good in terms of how he spoke, but he's not confident.
You're also a very aggressive interviewer, aren't you? It's like the Paxman of the football world. I'm not surprised he was shaking,
wagging your finger at him.
Yeah,
and so those people who've worked with him before, and I've spoken to a few. I've spoken to Christian Fromart as well, who also worked with him. And these people, they're very confident that he has this ability, and that there is certainly something there. But Newcastle, for whatever reason, are not getting the best out of it, and you just. What concerns me about this month, and it just seems to be Groundhog Day with Newcastle, is that they're going to have, at the moment it seems like they're looking for a short-term fix to a long-term problem, which is that last year they had a short-term fix of a year for Rondon, who they've signed on loan, albeit reluctantly, because the manager was so belligerent in trying to get him. And apart from that, they haven't had a centre-forward. When Joe Linton's in the team, the team sort of, in my opinion, lacks a bit of a focal point. When Carroll plays, although I think Newcastle are too direct, you can see that there is something to play off. There's someone to play off. Joe Linton doesn't look suited to that at the moment, and that's what Newcastle, as well as goals, need to get for the second half of the season. But it seems that what they want to do is try and defer solving the problem long-term till the summer, which I understand because the summer window is easier to deal in. But because of the mistakes of last summer, they're having to scramble around in January to find someone to play for the next 6 months.
2010 Andy Carroll, that's who we need. Is he available currently? Is he around? He's the type of player that we need, isn't it?
And you see glimpses of it still. I still like watching him play because he knows how to hold the ball up. He knows how to win a free kick. He knows he can defend brilliantly. He's sometimes Newcastle's best centre-half still. He makes those incredible clearances. And he set up a couple of goals because he knows what to do. He's such a good player, but he doesn't have the mobility that he used to have.
To use a technical term, he puts the shit up people, doesn't he?
I think he does.
Absolutely. I mean, you see defenders, they do take 10 yards back. They take a step back when he comes on the pitch. We were talking about this on the way up, about Andy Carroll and what he does and the sort of chaos he brings when he comes off the bench.
I think that's a big part of Andy Carroll's thing, is the fear he puts in defenders. In centre-halves, they know. One of my favourite Newcastle pictures is before a game at either Goodison or Stamford Bridge, it's Alan Shearer and Duncan Ferguson shaking hands at kick-off. And I can't imagine being a centre-half looking at that thing. You're going to get hurt today.
Yeah.
And I think when Andy Carroll comes on, centre-halves look at that and think, "This, it's changed now.
You're going to know you've been in a game, basically.
You can't stand off like you do with Joe Linton. You've got to engage him and he's going to hurt you.
Well, that was in a different sort of way, but what impressed me so much last season about watching Salomon Rondon up close was, because I remember when it became clear that he was Benitez's number one target the summer before, thinking, I quite like him. He hasn't got a great goal scoring record. I don't really see what the sort of fascination is.
There was a lot of that going around at the time, actually, when he was linked. There was a lot of people who weren't entirely sure about that.
Yeah, and I readily admit that I was one of them. But I remember it was actually the Leicester away game when Newcastle won 1-0 and Perez scored. But Rondon was absolutely fantastic. And I mean it in a way that you just saw how, and this is partly experience, which Joe Linton doesn't have yet, and hopefully he will get over time. But just the way he occupies defenders. And there was times where he didn't even watch the ball. He'd watch whatever defender was going to do and make sure that he profited from that by the second ball or whatever it was. Yeah. And that is what Newcastle are missing at the moment, that person who when Carroll plays, you get it to a certain degree, but mobility-wise, he still isn't quite up there, and fitness-wise, you're just not sure how durable he's going to be. Mm. And that is what they've lost in this last 18 months. And I said at the time, but I just think if you'd had Rondon and you'd had Joe Linton together,
yeah, exactly.
I just think that would have been the ideal scenario, really.
He would have been learning from the experienced hand. You know, he would have been able to come in and the pressure would have been off him. That would have been perfect. But we know in Newcastle United universe, that's not how things go, is it?
Well, no, in their universe, it was dead money. But, you know, the way they can't view this equation is that you can actually use experience to make your young players improve and to make your young players worth more money. There's a reason why Perez left for 30 million quid at the end of last season. I mean, how much would you have valued Perez at the start of last season compared to the end of...
Probably half or even less than half of that, I would say.
And so I'm not saying that's all to do with Rondon, but, you know, experience can improve other players. So whilst they lose value, other players gain value. And, you know, that's the side of things that they can never see. And I agree with Chris. Rondon wasn't a great centre-forward, but he was a proper centre-forward. And he would work defenders, and they would know that they've been in a game. And all those things are incredibly important to a team. And as I said before, the triangle with Perez on one side and Alma on the other worked. The thing about this team, as this is something I said on Twitter the other day, Hosolu would be a better player in this formation than Joe Linton is. Because he would work the centre-halves, he would know where to run, he would hold the ball up. He wouldn't be scoring goals because we've seen that he doesn't score goals.
Anyway, yeah.
But he would be in the right place. And the one of the big problems with Joe Linton, he's not going into the right places.
There was a point in the Rochdale game where the ball dropped into the box with within space, and he was kind of stood on the edge of the box with his hands on his hips. I think it was from a corner or a free kick. And you actually heard the audible groan from the entire, the support, the Newcastle United support there. That was the point where I thought, oh God, this is just becoming frustrating now. You know, you can see what you want him to do. It's there. Just get in there, put yourself about. This is what Andy Carroll does. I know he's not the greatest striker in the world, and he has mobility issues like we've spoken about, but he puts himself about. He makes it hard for the defenders, and he gets himself into these difficult positions where he can make things happen. And I don't get the feeling that Joe Linton's doing that, whether that's a confidence thing or whether he just doesn't have that in him. I don't know. What is it?
If you don't play him, who do you play? Who else is this? Carroll, I don't trust to get through more than 2-3 games in a row. Dwight Gayle doesn't appear to be in the picture. Muto doesn't really get much of a look in.
And is injured now as well.
Yeah.
That's not helping.
If you're talking about resting him or talking about, like you mentioned, send him away on loan, with whom do you replace him?
Mm.
I don't think there's anyone.
Shefki Kuchi on February the 10th.
Shefki Kuchi.
I saw him play at... I went to Blackburn away the week after Shefki Kuchi signed, and it was the coldest I've ever been in a football stadium. I think Blackburn Stadium is that temperature all year round, by the way. But he came on for the last 5 minutes, and everybody was laughing. We were all just laughing because it was like, this is ridiculous. This is what it's come to. Andy Carroll had been sold, and Shefki Kuchi came on.
The Kuchi monster.
And everyone just... couldn't. I think everyone was still drunk from Christmas and the New Year and all that, but it was just, what is this? What is going on here? Nothing seems to have changed.
Well,
yes,
thankfully things have got a lot better since then.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
So. I mean, there have been a couple of little bright points in the last couple of weeks. Matt Ritchie's returned from injury, which has taken a bit of time to come through, and there was talk last week of him needing another operation and we might not see him again for the rest of the season, but he came on against Rochdale and was instantly barking orders and telling everyone how shite they were. So it was nice to see him back.
It was nice to see him back, and I mean, I wrote early in the season about how important he is in terms of being that sort of cajoling presence in the side. And Bruce tried to, and I understand why he tried, but he kept on referring after the game to the fact that, oh, well, at least Matt Ritchie's back and we've got 25 minutes out of him, because he had to try and deflect from the fact that it was negative. He didn't hide from the fact that it was negative, but he kept on saying, Matt Ritchie's back, that's a positive. I actually thought that Ritchie and Key coming on changed the game in a negative sense.
Absolutely,
but I don't what I would say in mitigation for Bruce on that one is I saw a lot of people saying, why didn't you bring on the young lads who were on the bench? Elias Sorensen, who, let's remember, couldn't get a game for Carlisle United, and the other young lads who aren't considered to be ready for first team. If Bruce had brought those on and Newcastle had ended up drawing or losing the game, then he would have been hammered for that. He was in a sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't. He didn't have the strength to make a positive substitution off the bench. He had two injuries go off. And yes, that did negatively affect the game, but I just didn't see the situation.
He brought on as well were people who hadn't figured in the team for months as well, so they're not going to be up to speed, are they?
No.
And Richie's incredibly important to this team. He is the Raj of the team. He's permanently angry. He's a bit like Chris in that respect.
Yeah.
Very, very, very angry small man. He does sit in front of us in the press box. Or has been, and he gets very animated during games, and he's permanently cross. And you know, you sort of need somebody a bit like that in your team. The lad who was going to kick you up the backside, whether you've just cleared the ball off the line or scored a goal or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's always been this team's tempo setter, because he'll just run and run and run and run and run. And he kind of lifts people around him because of that. So I think, you know, short term, it's great to have him back.
I'm also looking forward to seeing a little bit more from Miguel Almirón in the next couple of weeks. He's amongst the goals, if you can call it that. He's now scored two goals. The goal against Crystal Palace, which I thought was a wonderful moment for him. It was absolutely brilliant moment. We haven't actually had the chance to speak about that because we haven't recorded a podcast since that game. And then the goal on Saturday against Rochdale, which he took very well. It's nice to see him smile. I mean, he was smiling anyway, even when he was having a hard time, but it's nice to see him playing and scoring.
I think that's been the best moment at St. James's Park this season. The absolutely. Atmosphere has been... Because of, for so many reasons, the atmosphere has felt down. But for that moment, it felt for a few minutes to a degree like the St. James's Park of all. But also, just there was just that outpouring of emotion. And actually, I think it extended beyond that. And it was almost the entire football world just seemed to be delighted for the fact that Almirón had finally scored. You could see how much he loved it. His celebration with the ball boy, and he has visibly seemed to grow in the last couple of weeks confidence-wise. I thought that we saw that in the... Yes, I know he missed a couple of chances against Everton where he snatched at them, but I actually thought the first half against Rochdale that there was a bit more of a swagger about him. There's a bit more willingness to take the ball, and hopefully that this is a bit of a turning point for him. I never think he's going to be prolific. I just don't think he's that sort of player, but hopefully this gives him, now that monkey is off his back, for want of a better term, hopefully that this just changes the season to a degree.
What would be wrong with having a monkey on your back?
I don't know. It depends what kind of monkey it is. If it's one of them mental ones that eats everything, then you're probably not going to want that, are you?
I'd love to be walking around with a monkey. Well, on my shoulder. I love a monkey.
Like
on
a
my
little
shoulder.
One.
Well,
like
just
a
now.
Like a capuchin or something.
Well, like, something. I like, what's that TV programme that's just been on where everyone has has demons, the Philip Pullman series. His Dark Materials. And everyone has a little demon. I'd love to have a little monkey on my back.
But could fleas be a...
maybe it's fleas.
In which case, you're already there.
Surely, having an elephant on your back would be worse than having a monkey. I'd like to have a monkey.
An elephant would be worse for your joints.
A giant silverback gorilla or something like that, you know.
Well, they're apes.
Oh, don't come here getting all technical with
me. Well, a little monkey who could sort of do little tasks for you during the day. I don't know.
What kind of tasks do you have in mind, George?
I don't know. Like, he's peeling bananas. I don't know.
Yeah. Just flinging shit around.
All right.
When it gets annoyed.
Maybe. I hadn't thought that through.
Six exactly. Old mouse, that happens anyway.
Excellent. So, FA Cup draw. Oxford United.
Well, we're in it.
Yeah. Yeah, that helps.
If we get past Oxford, we've got Oxford the next round.
Yeah. So, Rochdale, we have to play them in a replay that nobody needed or wanted. And then it's potentially another banana skin against Oxford United. I mean, let's be honest, as far as draws go, it's not bad, is it?
No, I think it's the best draw Newcastle have had in quite a while in terms of to have had two League One teams in a row. Now, I know they've made it difficult for themselves by having to have this extra game, but actually, Bruce's press conference on Friday, the pre-Rochdale press conference, for the first time in a long time in the Mike Ashley era, to hear a manager who... Although there's big injury problems, and he didn't hide away from those, and he did mention them, to actually speak positively about the FA Cup and insist that he was going to take it seriously. And he did play the strongest team available on Saturday.
Albeit, I actually
think that the injuries may have helped him in that regard, because he didn't really have a choice. So I think there may have been, in an IROC set, more changes if he'd had more players available. But that he didn't get the result he wanted. But for 45 minutes, it did feel different. And hopefully... if they can get through this replay against Rochdale, then have a home tie against another League One side, that fifth round ceiling, which Newcastle haven't been able to get by.
Can you imagine the scenes in the streets?
Extraordinary. Extraordinary.
Parties, you know, fifth jelly round. And ice cream. They'll be like VAD. We won't have seen the likes.
I've seen Oxford this season because I saw them put Sunderland out of the League Cup, so it's not necessarily a great omen, but on penalties. And they're a decent team and they're doing well this season. They're very interesting. They've got, in the sense they've got a good manager in Carl Robinson, and they're a very open-minded club that have, as far as he's aware, as far as I'm aware, the only psychotherapist who is a first team fixture, so not wow. psychologist but psychotherapist. That's working at the club. So they're a very interesting club and they do well. But yeah, I mean, come on, it's the best draw Newcastle could have hoped for. I was certain that they were going to get Chelsea away.
We normally get a Premier League team.
Yeah, and so there would be normally that thing of get through against Rochdale. We've got Chelsea away or something like that. It's a great chance. Bruce has spoken very well about the Cup and what it means and what it's meant to Hull when he was there and they got to the final. And yeah, certainly the attitude was right in terms of team selection. And I hope he carries on with it. I mean, I'm sick to death of watching Newcastle in relegation battles. I don't want them to go down. Equally, I've seen them go up and down all my life and I want to see Newcastle win something. I've long given up of that ever happening. But
that's a good job, really.
But I want to see them try. I want to see them try. And so there's a good chance to get the fifth round. Bring it on.
Excellent. Right then, chaps, we're going to wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your honesty and your chat. Thanks for joining us, Stephen.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks very much, Chris. Cheers, George. Cheers. Happy New Year to you all listening at home. And we shall be back with you next week. Take care.